Hi, good morning, or good afternoon. I'm Jeff Sikorskas. I cover chemicals for JP Morgan in North America. And today it's my pleasure to introduce the management of Air Products. Representing Air Products is Simon Moore. And Simon is a 32-year veteran of Air Products. And he's held many posts in the company. He was the Global Director of Electronic Materials. He worked in business development and hydrogen gases. He sold all kinds of merchant gases, industrial gases in California. He's lived on both coasts. He's lived in Asia. He knows Air Products intimately. And you know, right now he's the head of corporate relations and sustainability, as well as being Air Products investor contact. So we're really very pleased to speak with him today. Simon, I thought we might begin by me asking you about Air Products' current hydrogen business. You know, how large is it? How many tons do you make or sell? Where generally are its revenues? Is it a global business? Can you begin to talk about gray hydrogen right now?
Sure, Jeff. Well, first of all, let me just say thank you very much to you and the rest of the JP Morgan team for the opportunity to be here today. It's wonderful to have an opportunity to talk about hydrogen. We spent a lot of time talking about hydrogen, but I'm looking forward to a great on-point conversation. And I also really appreciate you starting the dialogue with where we are today, because I think sometimes in discussions with investors, there's a sense that hydrogen's something out there in the future. And I know we're going to talk a lot today about the potential for hydrogen in the future, but hydrogen is here today. Hydrogen has been here for decades. Air Products has the leading position in making, distributing, and supplying hydrogen from facilities around the world today. We make about 9,000 tons a day of hydrogen today. It's about 3 million tons a year. And as I said, every single day we're producing hydrogen. We're distributing it via pipeline, via truck as a liquid, via truck as a gas. And it's about 22% of Air Products revenue. So we have a business today, or I'll say our hydrogen business is more than $2 billion today. So for Air Products, hydrogen is very much part of today, and we are very, very excited about the future. Most of our hydrogen business is in the Americas, probably 80 plus percent of it. And that really is just a manifestation of the refining infrastructure, particularly in the US Gulf Coast, where we have the world's largest and longest hydrogen pipeline network, 1,000 kilometers with over 20 facilities. We do most of the rest of the balance is in Europe, including our Rotterdam pipeline network. And the hydrogen business today is fairly modest size in Asia, although we do expect that to be one of the growth areas going forward.
Okay. So when we think about the hydrogen opportunities for Air Products, is the traditional gray hydrogen business a business that has a growth trajectory? That is, before we get to blue hydrogen opportunities or green hydrogen opportunities, what happens to this $2 billion worth of hydrogen volume, or three million tons of hydrogen volume? Does it grow? Does it shrink? What happens to it?
Sure. Great question. And maybe I'll just, if I could go back a little bit in time, kind of talk a little bit about some of the key drivers of that hydrogen demand, and then we can sort of unpack where we are today. Sure. Yeah. So I think you've had two things, Jeff, as you know, as you followed ourselves over the last few decades. There's a growth in hydrogen demand, and then there's the concept of outsourcing. And those two things have combined to create significant hydrogen growth rates for Air Products. So the growth in hydrogen demand really 10 years ago to 20 years ago was driven by, guess what, regulations where the world wanted cleaner fuels. And I say it that way because obviously the world very much today is creating regulations focused on cleaner fuels. And so in some ways you can see an analogy for hydrogen growth in the past. The primary use of hydrogen today, as you know, Jeff, is used by refiners to clean up transportation fuels, particularly to take sulfur out of the transportation fuels so we have cleaner transportation fuels. So that's what drove the growth fairly significantly. I think more recently, we've seen some hydrogen demand growth from the chemical sector. We have a project in Texas, our largest hydrogen plant, Gulf Coast Ammonia, obviously supplying hydrogen to an ammonia facility. So that's been what's kind of driving the growth. And then I think if we think about going forward, I would say that we see petroleum refining being a key part of the world's energy solution for many, many decades to come. We're going to talk about how exciting the hydrogen opportunity is and the $12 billion that Air Products has committed to projects. But we believe that petroleum refining will be with us, a key part of the solution for a long time going forward. And then obviously there's the opportunity, as some refiners are doing, to look at renewable diesel. So that might take a conventional refinery, maybe convert it and produce renewable diesel, which is part of the energy transition. And of course, renewable diesel uses 4 or 5 times as much hydrogen per barrel as a conventional refinery does. So a conversion could actually create some additional hydrogen demand. But I think it's probably fair to say that the growth in the traditional petroleum refining side is certainly going to be a lot more modest than it was 10 to 20 years ago, no doubt about it. But that's going to be certainly supported by the new opportunities. And I'll just make one more point, Jeff, because you said, hey, sure, what do we kind of do with those existing assets? Of course, one of the opportunities is to retrofit those existing assets with carbon capture systems and reduce their carbon intensity. We did that 8 years ago at a pair of plants in Port Arthur, Texas. We retrofitted a carbon capture system and have been capturing about 1 million tons a year of CO2 since then. So we have the proven technology and we have the proven operating expertise to do that. So again, we do see some demand growth. Maybe it's a little bit more modest than before. We see the opportunity to evolve our existing assets potentially to reduce their carbon footprint. And we're excited about the new investments as well.
So if I understand what you've said to me, the demand for hydrogen in refinery applications will remain. Whether that demand is ultimately gray or maybe it's a bluer color, the hydrogen is needed. But it may be that some of the gray transforms itself into blue, or maybe the best way to think about the growth is a combination of blue and gray mixed together, or overall hydrogen growth itself, rather than the different colors. Is that fair?
Yeah, and I think I maybe even one step further, right? The colors are interesting, but what the world cares about is carbon intensity. Yes. And I think that's a really important concept, and we'll unpack that. If you take a look at our Canada project, it is blue, but it is net zero from a CO2 emission standpoint. And I know we'll get into that in a couple of minutes. And so I think the programs around the world that we see the most valuable programs being put in place, they don't dictate the production methodology. To be blunt, they don't really care whether it's blue or green. They focus on the carbon intensity. And the lower the carbon intensity, the more valuable that molecule is. So yes, there's two different ways to make hydrogen, blue and green. But I think, again, it's important to focus on the carbon intensity.
So one of the ways that Air Products is approaching the hydrogen market is through green ammonia. And, some of the questions that investors have, circle around the extent to which these applications are drop-in applications. That is, if you're going to take green ammonia and you're going to put it in a ship to power its engines, or you're going to sell it to an electric utility, you're going to find different turbines that will use it. Is this easy to do, or does the demand base really need to change itself in order to be able to use green ammonia?
Great. Well, good question, Jeff. Let me make a couple of points.
Sure.
Air Products is not getting in the ammonia business. Right?
Yes.
We are using ammonia as a transport mechanism for the hydrogen molecule. So for us, for the projects we've announced, the primary market opportunity is to use that ammonia as an efficient way to transport the hydrogen molecule around the world, then dissociate that back to hydrogen. But let me share some thoughts on your question, because it could be that some of that ammonia does get used. And I think, of course, the answer is it depends. I think if you look into a power plant, obviously coal-fired power plants can so-called co-fire ammonia directly. And of course, that can be gray ammonia, green ammonia, blue ammonia. So again, back to the conversation we had, what will matter is the carbon intensity. There was a recent RFQ put out by a Japanese utility to buy 500,000 tons a year of low carbon ammonia. And they said they're going to use that up to 20%. So essentially take coal, replace 20% of the coal with ammonia, so-called co-firing. So I believe that that is able to be done with very little modification. I think it is possible to run power plants on 100% ammonia, but I believe that that would require some changes to the facilities themselves. So there's a perfect example of even 20% replacement of coal by ammonia is a pretty significant ammonia demand. But again, I want to come back to our primary market opportunity. Our primary market focus is really around the transportation market. Yes. So providing hydrogen to the transportation market, and we're using ammonia to move that hydrogen molecule around the world efficiently.
Okay. And so the direction of Air Products is really toward transportation. In your opinion, is that very much a European market or an Asian market or a domestic market, or it's really a little bit soon to tell?
Well, I think it's probably all the above, and so a little bit soon to tell. Let me just maybe just expand on that just for a second. I mean, I think what we've talked about for the NEOM project and maybe the Louisiana project, there's a tremendous amount of opportunity for hydrogen. And maybe, Jeff, just to put them in a couple of buckets, I think we talk about, let's say, industrial applications, steel making with hydrogen. You could argue in a power plant is industrial application. A large quantity of consumption at a single site, and depending on where that is in the world, that could be an on-site plant, that could be imported. So I want to make it clear that in the long term, Air Products sees ourselves playing a key role in that type of market. So my reference to transportation was really just about the projects we've announced so far. And then within transportation, I think most people see tremendous value in hydrogen electric vehicles, hydrogen fuel cell vehicles, for the larger vehicles. And Jeff, as you know, it's interesting because these are all electric vehicles. They all have electricity driving an electric motor to drive these vehicles. It's just a question of where does the electricity come from? Of course, a battery electric vehicle, the electricity is made elsewhere, stored in the vehicle in the battery. And for a hydrogen fuel cell electric vehicle, you still have an electric motor driving the vehicle. You're just making that electric power on board with a fuel cell. So the relative merits of hydrogen versus battery, hydrogen really shines as the vehicles start to get bigger because the weight of the battery, they have to store more electricity, becomes more and more significant. So buses, trucks, trains, maybe airplanes one day, although I think that's a little bit further off. Those are significant market opportunities. And again, particularly around NEOM, we've talked a little bit about buses and trucks more than the others. And I don't want to skip over kind of the fundamental idea of hydrogen as energy, whether that's hydrogen blended into natural gas pipelines. We talked a little bit about hydrogen and power plants. Hydrogen can be a great storage facility for electric power as well. So there's a very large set of opportunities. We're excited about playing in all of those. But again, it's really that heavy transportation market focused on the current projects.
Do you see different regions as incentivizing the use of hydrogen in the future for the transportation markets differently? Is there, you know, one region that seems to be ahead of another, or one country that seems to be ahead of another? And how do they do it?
Yeah, it's a great question. Well, I think a lot of different ways is the simple answer to that. So we see a lot of activity, and everybody on this call today is aware of this. I think certainly Europe is probably a good place to start this conversation. There are some EU initiatives and programs. There are some country-specific initiatives and programs. In the US, California's low carbon fuel standard is very, very important. States in the Northeast are contemplating, as we speak now, legislation to support a move to zero emissions. And we certainly do see some activity in Asia as well. And so yes, Jeff, kind of the how, and that, look, at the end of the day, the hows are different in different places. Some of these are mandates. For example, some locations have mandated zero emission vehicles. So they have said, look, almost, I don't care what it costs, we are not going to have in this city or this province or this state any vehicles that have hydrocarbon emissions. So it's a zero emission vehicle. So really your choice then is a battery electric vehicle or a fuel cell electric vehicle. In other cases, as in California's, there's essentially an economic value created for the lower carbon, and that ratchets down over time. So if you want to sell transportation fuels in California, you've got to demonstrate a lower carbon footprint, and the, let's say, the bar for that diminishes over time. Other examples, there are some more direct subsidies, and whether those be capital subsidies or you know, subsidies per unit of fuel used. I think our view is, if we were asked, and we do get asked every once in a while, if we think the government's the best place for them to focus is on the demand side, help support the infrastructure build out, help support the need for governments and people to move in that direction. And to be honest with you, we'll take care of the supply side. We're already committed $12 billion to build this lower carbon hydrogen, and we're happy to continue doing that.
So in the United States, there's the 45Q tax credit. Are there any other meaningful tax incentives for hydrogen in the U.S.?
Well, I think the last year, the last 6 months has reminded us there's a big difference between things that are in law and things that are expected to become law, as it turns out. So, of course, the current 45Qs at $50 a ton are law, and that's important. Obviously, many folks thought that that number was going to increase to $80, $85. Production tax credits for hydrogen were being talked about. Hydrogen hubs are an important part of the DOE's strategy going forward. So I guess, Jeff, I would say there's a lot of things that were being actively considered. Our opinion is a number of those will probably happen in the future, but it's turned out to be difficult to predict what happens in a political framework. To be clear, our projects, the success of our projects does not depend on any additional support. We see that the support that's already in place, the direction the world wants to go, is going to create excellent projects that are going to deliver significant shareholder value.
So if the tax credit were raised, I don't know, from, $50 per ton of carbon dioxide to $100, would that make a meaningful difference in your financial returns for this $12 billion that you've invested?
So I think there's a direct and an indirect impact, right? So the easiest and most direct impact is, of course, the project in Louisiana. That's the project that's in the U.S. that we're going to sequester the CO2. And we're going to sequester 5 million tons a year of CO2. So to be blunt, if the 45Q tax credit is $50, even I can do this math, it's $250 million a year. If it doubled, it would be $500 million a year. So I think that one is very easy to see a very, very direct impact. You know, the other projects are in different places around the world. And so I think that would have perhaps a more indirect effect. It would, again, help promote the value of the lower carbon hydrogen.
You spoke of, different projects, and we'll begin to go through them. And you've sized them at about $12 billion. And, we hear of inflationary pressures all of the time in the building of different facilities. Are you comfortable that the outlays would really be $12 billion? Or do you think that might be, something of a conservative estimate at this point in time for your projects?
It's a great question, Jeff. And let me just for a minute talk a little about what our team does to come up with these estimates. So first of all, this is what we've been doing for decades. Estimating capital projects and delivering on the execution of that capital is absolutely core to Air Products. And we have been successful doing that in times of higher inflation and times of lower inflation. And so our team is very, very diligent about this. So they will, of course, think about where we expect costs to be. Now, look, if we were estimating a project 2 years ago, I'm not saying our team would have predicted today's inflation, but they wouldn't have based it on the costs at that time. They would have anticipated some level of inflation. for some of the key components in our projects, the major purchased equipment, we have locked in prices from our suppliers. Most traditionally, if we were talking about an air separation plant, the compressor is a major purchased piece of equipment. We would have fixed firm pricing from our vendor before we committed to the project. In the case of, let's say, the NEOM project, we announced in December that we had finalized the contract with ThyssenKrupp for the electrolyzer itself. Similar, a major piece of purchased equipment there. Another thing we do is that most of the engineering is done by our team, Air Products employees. And so certainly, obviously, we have to pay a competitive wage, but those engineering hours are our people. We're not seeing significant inflation in that area. And then the final point is that, you know, we manage this aggressively. We've got a lot of different sources around the world that we can source from. But Jeff, I'm not here to suggest to you that there's zero impact from the current inflation world. I think it's just you need to, you know, somebody that would say, hey, $12 billion, if that's a 10% inflation, that's a lot of money. I think the number is not zero, but I think it is much, much more moderate than people think. And again, let's look at the NEOM project, right? We're in the middle of executing that. We're going to provide that into the marketplace in 2026 and beyond, where we think there'll be significant demand for that zero carbon, low carbon hydrogen, and there won't be a lot of supply. So even if hypothetically there was a little bit of inflation on that project, I think that we're going to be in a market position which will allow us to more than recoup that.
So your basic idea is that just Air Products builds so many of its own plants that you don't have the same kind of inflationary pressures from using outside contractors. And correct. So much of what you're building is what you build already, which you can estimate and cost quite well.
Yep. And maybe just one last point would be, for example, the most recent project we announced, World Energy. Obviously, the timing of that estimate is done in a very inflationary environment. So again, I'm not saying that we're perfectly able to predict that, but yes. World Energy, you know, we only announced a few weeks ago. So obviously, we would be, let's say, more timely with our inflation outlook on that project.
Sure. Maybe what we might do is look at some of the projects that you're building. Right. In 2024, you have a $1 billion investment in Western Canada. Maybe you could tell us something about that hydrogen project that you're bringing on.
Sure. Well, I think before I dive to that project, just let me make a couple of points. I think one of the things that Air Products really has that distinguishes us is a portfolio of technologies and experiences. And we can bring the right combination of those technologies and experiences to bear to create the right solution for the right situation. And the reason I share that with you, Jeff, is there's some similarities, for example, between Louisiana and Canada, but there's some differences. And the differences are because of the unique circumstances of the projects. So we're excited about the portfolio of technologies that we have. And in Canada, as you know, we have an existing hydrogen pipeline network. So there's a similarity between World Energy, Canada, and Louisiana, where we've now got major investments that are all connected to our major hydrogen pipeline networks. So in Canada, we have large hydrogen plants, pipeline networks supplying some of the key chemical and refining customers up there. And what we're excited about here is this is an opportunity to demonstrate how hydrocarbon-based hydrogen can be part of the future. For the province of Alberta, this is really, really important because they have a lot of natural gas, and being able to see how that natural gas can play a key role in the energy transition is very, very important. So we're going to take that natural gas and we're going to gasify it. Happens to be a technology called an autothermal reformer, but it's a gasifier. We'll create syngas, and we'll be able to capture more than 95% of the CO2 from this project. That CO2 will go into something called the Alberta Carbon Trunk Line, which is existing infrastructure in place to support CO2 sequestration, and that will be sequestered. So the hydrogen that we're going to make from this project is really going to do a couple of different things. A significant amount of the hydrogen will be fed into our pipeline network and supplied to existing and future growth customers. who wants a lower carbon hydrogen. And I think one of the important things to recognize is we don't have to build a new so-called blue hydrogen pipeline network. You can put lower carbon hydrogen in at one end, mix it with traditional hydrogen, have somebody take out the molecules at the other end. And as long as you're accounting for the lower carbon hydrogen, you absolutely can use that existing infrastructure. So I think it's important for investors to recognize that while we have not yet announced any specific customers on this pipeline network, a significant amount of the hydrogen is going to be sold via the pipeline. And we've been selling hydrogen via pipeline for decades, all under kind of long-term on-site take-or-pay type agreements. So not foreshadowing anything, but I think it would be reasonable for investors to believe that certainly that pipeline hydrogen might look a lot like the business model that we have today for pipeline hydrogen. So again, one place the hydrogen is going is down the pipeline. Yep. The second place the hydrogen is going is we're going to liquefy the hydrogen, because we see in Alberta a very exciting opportunity for the heavy truck and bus transportation market, but we aren't going to be distributing this hydrogen around the world, right? We talked about using ammonia as an efficient distribution methodology for the hydrogen molecule, and that's particularly relevant if you're trying to move it from, say, the Middle East to Europe or to California, but in this case, it's a more localized market. And we think that we liquefy the hydrogen and we can distribute it efficiently. And we absolutely see that there's a growing market for low carbon hydrogen for transportation. So we're going to deliver that via liquid hydrogen. And then one more interesting thing is we're also going to take some of that hydrogen and we're going to put it in turbines. So back to your point, Jeff, about power production. And of course, these are new turbines designed to handle the hydrogen from the very, very beginning. So we will produce enough power to make this site self-sufficient. We will also export a little bit of power, and that low carbon power export offsets the little bit of CO2 that will be emitted. And therefore that's how we get to net zero. So sorry, that was a lot there, but that's what we're building and we're excited about it.
So when you put your carbon dioxide into the trunk line, is that a cost for you, or do people pay you for the carbon dioxide? What are the economics of that?
Sure. And it's a little hard to get into the details of our commercial arrangements and how that interplays with the Canadian thing, but it's progressing and developing exactly as how we expected it would. And that was absolutely part of our economics when we put the project together. Again, the Alberta Carbon Trunk Line is an example of Alberta's vision to say, hey, at some point in the future, we as Alberta are going to have to make sure there's an ability to take this CO2, some of it for where it's produced, and move it to a place where it can be sequestered. So it's a great opportunity to use that infrastructure that Alberta created.
So if I remember rightly, I think your plan was to make 30 liquid tons per day of hydrogen from that facility. And when the project was originally announced, I think the idea was that the market for that hydrogen would be the transportation market. Is the transportation market in Western Canada moving sufficiently quickly that it can absorb that amount of hydrogen? Or may it be the case that it takes longer for the liquid tons to be sold into that market?
I think it's developing very, very quickly. And I think if we could make the liquid hydrogen come on stream sooner, we'd be happy to do that. And again, Jeff, recognize that, as you know, is we have an existing network of liquid hydrogen plants. We've announced another green hydrogen liquid hydrogen plant in Arizona. And we have a number of existing gray hydrogen liquid hydrogen plants. And the reason that's important is because people who want to convert to hydrogen trucks don't have to wait for this facility to be on stream. They can convert and, if necessary, use gray hydrogen today, and they can run trial programs and they can get comfortable with the way the trucks work and the fueling and all that kind of stuff. And essentially, it would be a absolutely seamless transition over to low carbon hydrogen when this plant comes on stream. So the user would notice no difference between so-called gray hydrogen, maybe supplied from now till this plant comes on stream, and then they switch over. So I think that's one of the things that makes us very optimistic that You know, I'm not sure whether every single drop will be sold out on day zero, but I think that it is not a case where the customers need to start using it the day this project comes on stream. They can already be fully utilizing hydrogen before it comes on stream. And we are seeing great levels of interest from customers there and in other places.
So when we try to think about the rough economics of the project in Canada, is the 30 tons of liquid hydrogen equally important or maybe a little bit more important than the 300 to 400 tons per day of gaseous hydrogen? And, you know, I guess there's also the electric power element. Like, you know, if you had to rank order those three applications, you know, what's the rank order in terms of the economics for the shareholder of Air Products?
Well, really, Jeff, they're all important and they're all interrelated, right? Because the gasifier is making the hydrogen. Some of that hydrogen goes down the pipeline, some of that gets made into a liquid, and some of that gets made into power. But what this is all about is, again, bringing together this portfolio of technologies and creating in Alberta from a hydrocarbon net zero hydrogen. And really, I would just say, look, the net zero hydrogen that goes down the pipeline, we believe is going to have significant value to customers, potential customers, just like the liquid hydrogen will as well. So, Jeff, I think, you know, it's hard to pick a favorite child. So we like all three of these parts of the project.
I think Canada has a carbon tax. So, you know, is one of the features. So when you sell blue hydrogen in Canada, I take it that it avoids a certain tax element. Is there a premium for blue hydrogen in Western Canada versus gray hydrogen or, you know, does it sell at the same price? How does one think about that, those issues?
Right. And so our view is the lower the carbon intensity, the higher the value. And I think that comes from a couple of different buckets. Again, there may be some specific rules and regulations that are in place to, you know, create a certain amount of value for that. But Jeff, I don't need to tell you or anybody else on this phone that every single company that's involved in this needs to lower their carbon footprint, right? And they're under, you know, requests or pressure from investors, from communities. So I think there also may be an element that there would be customers who will value that lower carbon hydrogen, even if there isn't exactly the tax or credit to kind of connect the dots there. And again, we are seeing a great level of interest. I think that you can imagine that there's pipeline customers who are very aware of our project announcement. There are existing customers today. So you can imagine that we didn't have to wait till we announced the project to start those discussions. Now, yes, you've got to sort through if there is some sort of government incentive, how does that end up in the project? Does, let's say, our customer get that, in which case they pay us a higher price? Do we get that, in which case we sell the hydrogen at a lower price? Those are, in my opinion, details that we work through with a customer, but we do absolutely think there'll be value for the lower carbon hydrogen in all of these market opportunities.
Do we know how much carbon dioxide will be emitted by the whole complex?
So when you say emitted or sequestered, I just wanted to make sure that we were clear about that. About 95% of the CO2 is going to be captured and sequestered. I would just say also, Jeff, the regulations, the rules, the support mechanisms in Canada are evolving as we speak as well. So I think that, you know, there may be some changes to that going into the future as well.
So what I mean is, how big is the 5% that goes into the atmosphere? Like, how many tons is that? Does one know?
So I'm not sure if we disclose that, Jeff. So
okay, all right. Maybe what we might do is turn to the Louisiana project, which I think is a $4.5 billion project. What do you plan to spend that money on? What's the output of that that complex going to be like? And, you know, do we have a clear idea of exactly what's going to be built yet.
So I think if it's okay, I'll do the classic compare and contrast, if that's sure. okay. So relative to the Canada project. So in some ways, this is very similar. We're in the state of Louisiana, who, like the province of Alberta, it's very important to the state of Louisiana to see a role for them to play in a lower carbon future. So one of the reasons why the governor of Louisiana has been a big supporter of carbon sequestration is he understands that Louisiana has the right geology, but as importantly for the economy of Louisiana, they need to be able to play a role in a lower carbon future. So what I mean by that is we're going to take natural gas, we're going to gasify it. It's a POX unit versus an ATR, but I would suggest that those differences are fairly modest. It's a gasifier. So yeah. we're going to gasify the natural gas for the same reason as we do up in Canada, where that when you gasify the natural gas, you can capture a much higher percentage of the CO2. So again, we're going to capture greater than 95% of the CO2. That what we're going to sequester is about 5 million tons a year of CO2 from this project. So we're going to produce significant quantity of hydrogen, about 750 million standard cubic feet a day. And then again, we have the hydrogen and we look at the market opportunity. And we say, okay, we're going to connect this to our existing Gulf Coast hydrogen pipeline network, the world's longest pipeline network, 1,000 kilometers. So we'll take some of this low carbon hydrogen, put that in the pipeline network. And this will be the same comments I made about Canada. We have existing customers. They're interested in lower carbon hydrogen. Yes, we haven't announced anything yet, but I think it's reasonable for you to assume that that business will look a lot like our existing pipeline business. So some of the hydrogen gets sold in the pipeline network. Some of the hydrogen in this case is going to get converted to ammonia. So we're going to produce an ASU to create the nitrogen. We'll have the hydrogen. We'll build an ammonia plant. And the reason we're building an ammonia plant, not a liquid hydrogen facility, is we see the opportunity to export from this site to the opportunities around the world, if nothing else other than geography, right? On the coast as opposed to Alberta. So we take a look at those different opportunities to distribute the hydrogen in the most efficient way. And in this case, we're going to make ammonia. And then we see this similar opportunities as we talked about around the NEOM project, transportation. Potentially, there could be some in the power market, particularly in Japan, but we really see exporting that ammonia, dissociating or cracking that ammonia back near the point of use, and that's how you can deliver much, much lower carbon hydrogen into those transportation markets. So basically, the $4.5 billion is a big gasifier, an ASU, an ammonia plant, carbon sequestration facilities, and that's what we're doing for the $4.5 billion.
Do we know, thank you for that. Do we know how big your ammonia facility will be?
Well, Jeff, that is a question that we have not answered yet. So we know what we're going to do, but we have not communicated to the market how much of ammonia versus how much hydrogen. You could perhaps guess that we're in the middle of some interesting conversations with customers and you know, I think that we haven't shared that publicly at this point. But rest assured, it'll be a significant amount of the hydrogen will both be sold as hydrogen and as ammonia.
So how do you grapple with that question of the amount of ammonia you wish to make as opposed to the amount of blue hydrogen you wish to put into a pipeline? How do you weigh which direction to go?
Sure. And the answer is it's a balance. And I think one of the things that's important to recognize is while we have the world's largest hydrogen pipeline network, kind of the only place the hydrogen is going to go is to the customers on that pipeline network, right? So there's a lot of chemical and refining facilities down on the US Gulf Coast, but that's the only place it could go.
Right.
When you think about the ammonia, using ammonia to transport the hydrogen, just like NEOM, as we talked, once you've kind of got that on the ship, of course, it can go anywhere in the world. So what I think we want to make sure we do is we're able to support the demand growth by our customers for lower carbon hydrogen on the pipeline network. And then also, this won't be the only facility where we're taking ammonia, moving it around the world to support hydrogen. As we said, the Dion facility is very similar. What we don't do, Jeff, I could just maybe say it this way. We don't look at today's price of ammonia and decide that this would be a great business and we want to get in the ammonia business. It is a pretty good price. But as you and I have talked, Jeff, and I don't want to go through all the details now, sure. But I do think that investors sometimes feel like this is a $4.5 billion bet on the future of hydrogen. I'd like to maybe just ask people to think about that for just a second. Let's hypothesize that it turns out we're wrong. There's no energy transition and there's no value for hydrogen. I don't happen to think that's the case. I don't think you think that's the case, but let's talk about that as a downside scenario. If that happens, we'd spend $4.5 billion. And let's say hypothetically then that we made all of the product into ammonia, just hypothetically. And let's pretend for a moment, there's no value above today's, or not today's, but gray ammonia. So we couldn't get any value from the low carbon hydrogen. It didn't help our hydrogen pipeline network, and there was no value for low carbon ammonia. And if you look at that and you do a very simple analysis, I think investors will find out that this project is not bad.
Yes.
Even in that very, very unlikely, very conservative downside case, it's not a bad project. And then you start to layer on some of the opportunities for, wow, I'm pretty sure low carbon ammonia is going to have a higher value than traditional ammonia, and I'm pretty sure low carbon hydrogen will have a similar value. So I have to acknowledge, of course, there's some risk around this project, right? It's hard to do a first mover without some risk, but I think it would be not appropriate to sort of say, hey, this is a $4.5 billion bet.
How much ammonia could you make with the amount of hydrogen that you're producing and given your capital?
Yes. Sure. Good question. Again, if we took all of the hydrogen and made ammonia out of it, it'd be about 3.5, 3.6 million tons a year of ammonia. Again, that's not our plan. That's not what we're expecting to do. But I think that is a way that investors can perhaps frame kind of almost a downside case on this project.
Are ammonia plants, is there a continuous scale in the building of ammonia plants, or does it turn out you want to build them in, I don't know, 1.2 million ton units? In other words, when you make the decision as to what you'll do, you'll say, well, you know, is it that it can be, you know, anything from zero to, you know, 3.6, or is the more likely outcome to be, you know, maybe it's 1.2 or 2.4 or 3.6. Are there natural breaks or it's more continuous, if you know?
I think there are some natural breaks. I mean, they're flexible in where those breaks are, but I think there are some natural logical breaks.
You know, Air Products has filed all kinds of different patents having to do with the dissociation of hydrogen from ammonia at fueling stations. Is this an opportunity for some of the material that would come out of the Louisiana project? You know, might it go to hydrogen fueling stations in the United States?
Yeah, and so thanks for noticing, Jeff. And I think this goes to, again, as we talk about Air Products experience, again, we've talked a lot about the production of hydrogen so far. We've got a lot of experience there. We got a lot of technology. We've talked about different options for distributing hydrogen, pipeline, trucks, ammonia. We've got experience in those areas and we've got technology in those areas. But let's continue down that supply chain. For this to be valid and helpful for a transportation mechanism, you've got to deliver it into the vehicle. Well, we've got over 100 projects we've executed around the world where we are delivering hydrogen into the vehicle. And so just to continue the supply chain, if we talk about it being sourced by ammonia, either from Louisiana or for NEOM, the ammonia gets landed, gets stored, it gets so-called cracked or separated back into hydrogen. That hydrogen will be compressed, stored as a gas. And then the dispensing station itself, which looks a lot like a traditional gas station or diesel dispensing station, that's something that Air Products actually has some patents on. And the actual dispensing mechanism to put the hydrogen into the vehicle. And so when we talk about full line supplier and the opportunity to create value in this full supply chain, we literally mean all the way from raw materials to hydrogen into the transportation vehicle. So we have some patents, as you pointed out, there's some additional things we're doing there. I would just like to say, when we talk about the patents for the dispensing, we recognize the world has to have a consistent standard. You can't have different hydrogen fueling stations and different. So we've made that patent available for others, for a pretty nominal fee. But the point is that we have this technology that allows us to be the full line supplier. And that's why we can go to the city bus authority of XYZ city and say, look, we'll make all this happen. We'll make the hydrogen show up. We'll build the station for you. And I think that's a very, very attractive proposition for the customers going forward.
Because there are ammonia pipelines that go from Louisiana into the Midwest. Do you have any aspirations to, you know, have hydrogen fueling facilities in the Midwest, you know, late in the decade?
Sure. And I think it depends on how the market develops, right? If the programs are in place that would support that, I think that would be very interesting. Just like we talked about in hydrogen, you don't have to build a separate new low carbon ammonia pipeline. You can put the ammonia in and you can take the ammonia back out. So certainly, Jeff, that is a possibility. And maybe if I could just build on another example of that, we talked about the World Energy Project in California. And one of the things we're excited about that is we've connected that facility to our existing pipeline network. That pipeline network runs very, very close to the port there in Southern California. So there's an example where maybe it's not exactly what we said, but we could bring ammonia into Southern California, crack it, and supply zero carbon hydrogen to World Energy through our pipeline network. So I just share that with you as another example of some thinking similar to what you said is, hey, could you move low carbon ammonia through the pipeline network? Certainly that's possible.
So maybe we should turn now to the NEOM project in Saudi Arabia.
Okay.
Which is a very large project for you, where you're investing almost $4 billion. And mm-hmm. you're going to make 1.2 million tons of green ammonia. Mm-hmm. In general, is there an order that the project has to be built in? Do you have to build the solar panels first and the wind turbines next and the ammonia plant third, or can all of the different pieces of the plants come together at once?
Well, my answer is going to probably be insulting to our project team, who's got to go build this very, very complicated project. So let me apologize in advance. Essentially, we'll try to bring it all on stream at the same time. Now, of course, it's not that simple. I acknowledge it's very complicated, but there's no reason why you have to have one or the other significantly in advance. You'd like to bring the project up at the same time. So we would look to have the project on stream as we've committed and look to bring all those pieces together at the same time.
So recently when you were talking about your sustainable aviation fuel project that will come in California. I believe your CEO was discussing perhaps bringing green ammonia from the NEOM project to California. Why was that a possible use of the green ammonia? How does that make sense within the projects that Air Products is executing?
Well, and again, it's a potential, as you noted, Jeff. So, yeah. But how would it make sense? Well, first of all, again, we think California's low carbon fuel standard is very, very well designed, because, again, it doesn't dictate how you make the hydrogen. The lower the carbon footprint, the more value. So the low carbon fuel standard values zero carbon hydrogen a little bit more than it does very low carbon hydrogen. So that could create an opportunity. From a supply chain standpoint, as I mentioned, we're very excited that we connected World Energy's Paramount site. We've actually already done this, Jeff, to our existing hydrogen pipeline network in Southern California. That pipeline network already goes very close to the port. So you could land the ammonia, you could crack the ammonia, you could put then the hydrogen into the pipeline network, and you could deliver that zero carbon hydrogen into the Paramount site through that supply chain. So a possibility, an exciting opportunity, one of the many, many opportunities for the product.
Right. Okay. I think originally you thought that it might cost you $2 billion to build an infrastructure to distribute and crack the green ammonia that you're going to produce. Mm-hmm. Have you made any progress on the building of this infrastructure? You know, is it weighted more toward the United States or Europe or Asia, or it's a little too soon to tell?
Well, again, I think that we see small examples of this, right? We are literally every week, we are winning what I'd call trial or test programs where somebody wants to install one dispensing station to support three or four buses that they're going to buy on kind of a trial basis. So I'm not trying to kind of overplay that as a big part of the $2 billion. I'm just pointing out that you do see the beginning of the build out of that infrastructure. And most importantly, build out of customer demand, which we, again, will think will be very easy for those customers to convert in the future. So we have, we are spending a lot of time on this, Jeff. I think we haven't announced anything yet. You can imagine this is something that we want to be successful with and probably tell folks after we've been successful with it. But we are very actively developing that downstream supply chain infrastructure. Some of these will be fairly small investments. You know, there'll be a handful of dispensing stations at the customer site. But if you were to consider, hey, if we had to go build an ammonia tank and a cracking system at a port and be able to distribute that, that might be a pretty significant individual investment as well. So we are actively working on specific sites in all of those areas.
In terms of
I'm sorry, you did ask about kind of locations around the world. Again, and no surprise, but there's certainly opportunities in Europe. There's certainly opportunities perhaps in California, and we could see opportunities in Asia as well. Sorry about that.
Okay, no, it's all right. So when you think of the economics of the project in NEOM, where mm-hmm. there's very, very large capital outlay for very, very relatively few tons of ammonia. You know, you were talking about maybe 3.5 or 3.6 in the US, 1.2 in Saudi Arabia, but the investment is relatively comparable. Would the economics of the green ammonia production, you know, be very, very low cost, though capital intensive? Is that the way to think about the production of that material?
Jeff, I think you said it very, very well. Let me just build out a little bit on the answer to your question. At the end of the day, these are two fundamentally very different, if you will, cost stacks. And the reason for that is the project in NEOM is making its own electric power. It's not buying electric power. We're investing capital in the wind and solar to make our own power. So essentially, there's zero feedstock cost in the NEOM project. You have operating costs, you have people, you have maintenance, but you have zero feedstock costs. So as you said, that's quite a high capital intensity, but zero feedstock costs for the NEOM project. Yes. And then if I go over to the Louisiana project, I have a relatively lower carbon intensity, capital intensity, as you pointed out, but I got to consume, buy a whole bunch of natural gas and a whole bunch of power. Right. So on one project, very high capital, very low zero feedstock costs. On the other one, lower capital intensity, but I do have feedstock costs. So yes, you could think about the profit per ton, however you want to look at it. At the end of the day, we're obviously focused on the profit per dollar of capital invested, and we're very excited about the returns on both of these projects.
Well, $1,200 ammonia at, you know, close to zero cost. It might be difficult to find hydrogen returns that are, that are that competitive, at least at this point.
I just want to make sure, Jeff, you're guaranteeing $1,200 a ton for ammonia for the next 30 years. Is that what you said?
Well, even for 1 year, that might be okay. In California, you've got a sustainable aviation fuel project. And I think it's supposed to produce 340 million gallons of sustainable aviation fuel in 2025. Is there a market for that in 2025? Can, you know, are there a sufficient number of planes that could actually use that fuel? Or does the project have to, you know, ramp up over a longer period of time?
Well, great question, Jeff. And one of the reasons why we're excited about this project is that market exists today. One of the greatest things, or the one of the most positive reasons that we feel good about sustainable aviation fuel, is it's a direct drop-in replacement for jet fuel. The airplanes, the engines have to do nothing differently. There's sustainable aviation fuel flights going on all the time right now. The FAA has already approved this up to a 50% blend. So SAF 50%, jet fuel 50%. World Energy today makes sustainable aviation fuel at that Paramount site, which primarily, no surprise, goes to the local airport there, the very large LAX airport. And so what we see is this is the way for the airlines to reduce their carbon footprint. Because again, as I said earlier, maybe we'll talk about hydrogen for airplanes in a few decades, but for now, the fact that you can have a much lower carbon footprint drop in fuel is what we think creates the demand. Now, to be clear, our project, it's World Energy's responsibility to market the sustainable aviation fuel. Ours is a 100% on-site take or pay. We get paid by World Energy regardless of the price or the volume of the feedstock or the selling, a traditional on-site deal. But again, as Seifi always says, is, hey, that's great, but you've got to feel good about the overall project. And that's why we do.
Okay. Well, Simon, thank you very much for a global tour of the projects of Air Products. And we really wish you and Air Products the best of luck in your hydrogen endeavors. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much for the opportunity, Jeff. Hope everybody has a great day. Bye.
Good. Take good care.